Surpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000,000,000 kalpas. Now I can see and hear it, accept and maintain it. May I unfold the meaning of the Tathagata's truth.
Surpassed, profound, and wondrous Dharma. Help. It's a different feeling chanting that verse, you know, sitting on this seat. So like, it's kind of daunting. So I better listen very, very carefully so I can hear it. It's great to be back. I'm sorry. Was it last month that I missed, or have I been here since I missed?
No, you were here last month.
Oh, sorry. Right here. It's all a blur. Well, it's nonetheless, it's great to be back. It's really great to be back. It means a lot to me, especially in a time of difficulty, in a time of sorrow, to have brothers and sisters, Sangha, to be with. Is that thing?
It is on.
Okay. I've been sick. I came down with a pretty serious cold, and I've been in bed for most of the week. And I got my first good night's sleep night before last, and then I stayed in bed and slept throughout the day. And consequently, I didn't get a whole lot of sleep before coming here this morning. Mm-hmm. And I arrived and sat the first period of Zazen without my usual enthusiasm, but I'm feeling better. Sangha stash here. I'm still a little sick. I've discovered, you know, I felt pretty healthy yesterday. Been driving on Highway 1, I started getting nauseous. Not feeling so good. But anyway, that's not what I wanted to talk about. I'm not sure what I want. Well, I do have a notion of what I want to talk about. Says, today, like every other day, we wake up empty and scared. Don't open the door to the study. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty you love be what you do. I'll say that again. Today, like every other day, we wake up empty and scared. Don't open the door to the study. Take down the musical instrument. Let the beauty we love be what we do. I've known that poem for some time now. And I've always found it very moving. It's frank honesty. Today, like every other day, we wake up empty and scared. That starts off in a very unsentimental tone, in a very frank tone. Today, like every other day, I hear in that we don't wake up empty and scared because we're pathetic, deluded beings. We don't wake up empty and scared because we're weak. or sinful or flawed. No, today, like every other day, we wake up empty and scared because of where we find ourselves. If we choose to wake up, we find ourselves here. In a place of contradiction, a place of unpredictability. Where unspeakable, horrible things can happen. You don't know when or where. So it's not because, it's because of where we, if we choose to wake up, it's where we have to wake up to that creates a feeling. It's provocative of dread. Possibly, or an empty ennui or meaninglessness looms on the horizon. If we choose to wake up here, that emptiness, that feeling of, you know, of what's the point, can arise in the heart and fear. Through no fault of our own, more or less. That's, you know, this is where we must wake up. So, it's, you know, stating the human condition. And, then the second part of the poem offers an alternative to theodicy. Now, for those of you, unlike my friend Paul, who aren't theologians, you may not know what the word theodicy means. Anybody here not know what the word theodicy means?
I can't.
Theodicy.
Theodicy.
Theodicy. It's the endeavor to explain if God is all-powerful and all-good and all-loving, why is there evil? Why is there pain and suffering? And why do the innocent suffer? Why do the guilty flourish? So theodicy is the theological attempt to explain that. Don't open the door to the study, it really says. That won't do it for you. Trying to ferret out why things happen that tear at the heart and boggle the mind doesn't seem to help. At least not completely. I think there is some need to know, some need to try to understand what causes the tragedies and the horrors that occur. It's necessary to try to understand the causes, but that in and of itself can sink the heart and mind deeper and deeper into this whirlpool of ancient twisted karma. You see that the perpetrator of the deed is perpetuating the suffering that she or he has inherited from way back when, and it seems the pit of hopelessness can deepen if all you do is open the door to the study. If all you do is try with your rational mind to understand where we have to wake up, the fear and the emptiness does not necessarily dissipate. So Rumi says, don't open the door to the study. Take down a musical instrument. Let the beauty you love be what you do. It also is the case that where we must wake up is a realm of unspeakable beauty. The sound of a bird. The dancing of the leaves in the wind. Unspeakably wondrous. But to wake up to one requires that we be awake to the other. If we have armored our hearts out of fear, from where we have to wake up with its contradiction, with its pain and grief and sorrow, then our hearts are armored. And we can't armor ourselves to one thing and stay open to another. So this is the task. The task is to be fully human. The practice is to learn to have the courage to be fully human in this realm in which we find ourselves. In Sanskrit, it's called the Saha world, which is usually translated as the world of endurance. Meaning that this world is fairly endurable. And the sutras usually explicate that to mean that it's got just the right amount of suffering. Just the right amount. If there were any more, we couldn't practice. We would be overwhelmed. We wouldn't have the juice to practice. If there were any less, we wouldn't want to practice. We'd be too blissed out. We wouldn't feel enough pain to motivate us to practice. So that's, that's opening the door to the study, I would say, in a certain sense. That's trying to explain why this world is barely endurable. But that's beside the point, I feel. The fact is that this world is barely endurable, and our humanity is perpetually at risk. Each morning we wake up empty and scared, and we're confronted with the question, do I have what it takes to step forward into this day as a human? With all the consequences of stepping forth as a human. One of the things in this world that is unspeakably beautiful I heard it this morning, the sound of a child at play. I heard the sound of that child at play, and my mind went very, very rapidly to Connecticut. And the children were slain shortly before Christmas in Connecticut. It's hard for me to hear the sound of children or to see children and feel their incredible preciousness without feeling something of what had happened, what has happened there. in Tassajara, at the beginning of one of the practice periods, I forget who was leading that particular practice period, but they posted a quote from Dogen on the Zendo wall on the outside. And I don't even know if I can remember it accurately, but something like, the purpose of Ango, the purpose of practice period, is to deepen and broaden our faith. And so that was the quote that was put up at the beginning of practice period, and it stayed up there for a while, a week or two, I'm not sure how long. And, you know, I found that encouraging and interesting, you know. In California Zen circles, we don't use the word faith a whole lot in describing practice, or the point of practice. And it brings forth the question, well, faith in what? Or it can beg that question to the people trained in Western religious circles, because there's usually an object of faith. But, and we could say faith in Buddha, but then that would require some unpacking, because what is Buddha? You know, that's a big question, right? What is Buddha? And if you don't answer right, you'll get hit. You know? and if you point, and you know, some rascal will say, oh, right up there, that, you know, and then and that's the iconoclastic answer, you know. And then others say, you are Buddha, you know, like, I had a game that I played with Jacob when he was a baby. I'd say, not a baby, but you know, like a toddler. I said, who the Buddha? You the Buddha. And so there's that other teaching that, you know, Buddha is something that is not some person separate from us, but it's a quality of being that is potential for everyone. So it's not so easy to say, or to identify, or to point to the object of faith in Zen. But this morning, when I'm thinking of it, I think of that poem of Rumi's where he says, let the beauty you love be what you do. For me, the faith that is nurtured in practice is the faith that in spite of it all, this moment is precious. That in spite of it all, to be conscious is an incredible blessing and gift. And that practice period, in its very austerity of stripping away the non-essentials, kind of like in Walden when Thoreau says, I went to the woods to, anybody remember how that goes? I went to the woods to do something, to strip away all the inessentials and get to the basics of life. And if it were mean or if it were rough, to just embrace the very roughness of it. And that's a very crude reconstruction of Walden, but you know, practice period is essentially the same thing. You know, it's a very austere schedule. You know, you don't have much discretionary time, not a whole lot of distractions and frivolous divertissements. You know, you sit and you eat, you chant, defecate when you need to, sleep, and then get up, do the same thing the next day. And something about the rigors of practice period allows one to sometimes apprehend the jewel of consciousness in how cold the room is, or the sound of a blue jay, or the way the steam rises from the soup as, you know, you're being served your food. Just the plain, ordinary elements of consciousness can take on a jewel-like quality. see that being alive in this moment is a thing of unspeakable beauty. And that practice period can offer a window into that. I think that's what Dogen is talking about. That practice period can deepen our faith in being alive, in just being alive. If we're not careful, we'll make something of that. If we're not careful, oh, maybe I'm about to get enlightened. Wow, this is cool. You know, grab onto it as some sort of acquisition or attainment. But it's just introducing us to the wonder of just being a human being. So that maybe we can summon the courage to persevere as a human being in this Saha world. And I think that's the only thing that will save us. The armoring of the heart, which is so understandable given the horrors, will not save us. The unwillingness to feel fully the pain of things will not save us. That will allow for the space for the horrors to continue. On some gut level, I really feel that, I really believe that, that the path for healing requires, you know, a full awareness. But another feeling that I've been having today is, you know, we don't seem to have the space to fully heal. Begin to recover from one event and then another one occurs too quickly on its heels. And I get an empty and scared feeling in my heart when I allow myself to think that way. This is meant to be a pep talk, by the way. Really, it really is. But one that, you know, is cognizant of where we actually are, so that we can actually fulfill our vows. We can't fulfill our vows if we check out. We have to summon the courage to actually persevere where we are. And there's a story about that. I may have told this story before, about how Avalokiteshvara got all those heads. You know, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, is represented iconographically sometimes as having, you know, 1,000 arms and 11 heads. And there's a story in a Tibetan text called the Mani Kabu about how it happened that Avalokiteshvara got all those heads and the limbs to go with it. And the story goes that Avalokiteshvara made this vow to save all beings from hell. And he/she said, I will never relinquish this vow, and I will never stop. If ever I give rise to the thought of despair or discouragement, may my head blow up. And so, having made that vow, I will get as far as proceeded down into hell, began her work, and sure enough, beings were being liberated from hell, and she was feeling some gratification for her efforts. But then Amitabha Buddha said, Avalokiteshvara, look behind you. And so he turned his head, and lo and behold, he saw that for every thousands of beings that were being released from hell, that many thousands of beings more were falling into hell. And upon seeing that, her head blew up. And so, Avalokiteshvara restored her head. And she went back into hell and proceeded to do that thing of liberating beings from hell. And once again happened to look over her shoulder and saw that still the same thing was going on. Yeah, that, you know, for every X amount of beings being liberated, X amount of beings were falling in. And once again, the head blew up. And I'm paraphrasing the story. So Amitabha Buddha says, all right, fine. We got to work on a solution here. I know what we'll do. I'll give you 11 heads. That way, when one blows up, and I'm doing the repair job on that head, you'll still have 10 that are online that can do the work. And then when that one's repaired, by then probably I'll have to be working on another head, you know. But that way you can continue your work, you know. And so it's stated a little bit more eloquently in the Mani Kampum, but that's the essence of the story, of how it gets around at all those heads. And it, you know, we take these bodhisattva vows. We vow to be Avalokiteshvara's hands and eyes in this world. Which fundamentally and simply means to see suffering. To not flinch from seeing suffering. And that's so very hard, but absolutely necessary for any hope for our humanity to survive intact in this world. And sometimes we say understand suffering, but I'm beginning to come to the view that it's not so much understanding as simply being with as much humanity, meaning empathy, compassion as possible. And whatever preciousness there is about being human, about our species, requires of us that we do this. That when things that threaten our very sanity because of the gravity of the grief involved, that's the very time that we are called upon to be with that suffering. And facile rationalizations about it or other ways of averting from the pain of it diminish our humanity. So that Friday morning, when I heard the news about what happened in Connecticut, it was about a half hour before the staff meeting, and where I'm the director, and my mind was reeling. Heart was breaking. And I said, how can I possibly go to a staff meeting right now? But how can I not? So I'm the mission director of the organization. How could I not show up? And so I decided to show up and share the news. Because that's the only thing in my consciousness in the moment was the news, and to do anything less would, to go in and pretend to conduct a meeting, you know, and not reference what I had just found out about, seemed totally absurd and false. So I did. And then I said, you know, what could I possibly say about this? And I asked that, I asked everyone if we could just sit quietly for a few minutes. And then I excused myself. I said, I'm sorry, I don't have any agenda items today, and I really have to go. I left, and I got in my car, and I just started driving randomly around Salinas for a while. What should I do? What should I do? And I thought, well, I could drive to Big Sur. And, you know, that wouldn't work. And then finally, the answer that came to me was, I need to go sit. So I drove back to Dorothy's, where I work. We have a meditation room in the upstairs. And I went and I sat. And I sat. On the same hunk of rock that those parents were on, are on, whose hearts must be filled with such pain. And I sat on that same hunk of rock that those children are sitting on, who have been traumatized beyond my ability to comprehend. And I felt some measure of composure. My grief didn't lessen, but I was able to embrace it. To some extent, I was able to embrace it. I was able to feel a modicum of love. And I chanted, sometimes I would chant the Enmejuku Kamigyo for the survivors of what had happened. So in Buddhism, we put a big emphasis on awakening. You know, that's the thing that we're endeavoring to do. And I think it's really, really important that we think of awakening, that we're just awakening to being fully human. We're not looking for any kind of escape route. Some realm of bliss where we can listen to shakuhachi music and smell incense and see Buddhas dancing in front of us and have a wonderful, glorious time. That's a temptation. I'm making a caricature of it. I'm making a cartoon of it. But in practice, we can experience the power of the practice. We can experience the power and peacefulness of a concentrated mind. And we can pursue that. And if we're skilled, we can get deeply concentrated. And we can develop personality strength that will feed our egos in gross or subtle ways, and will be of no use to the world. see awakening as just being a plain human being in all of its rawness, if we can find the courage for that, we'll be of help. We'll have the possibility of being of help. And we'll find the courage to continue to appreciate the beauty that suffuses everything. Even though it kind of hurts to stay open enough to be able to appreciate the beauty that's suffusing everything. There's a price to be paid to hear how precious children's laughter is. At least right now. There's a price to be paid to actually hear the fullness of the beauty of a child's laughter. And what the alternative is to lose a portion of our humanity. Ask you all to find the courage to make the choice to stay human in this world that we're living in. The only other thing I have to say is Happy New Year.
To you too.
Okay, we close with the universal dedication. Oh, before we close, I usually ask if there's any conversation. And I don't want to not do that. Any questions, comments?
Oh.
Larry.
Yeah, I just want to thank you for that. I grew up not far from where that happened. Actually, it's kind of funny because my mother, Newtown used to have a mental institution. Mm-hmm. And my mother would always say when we were driving to cruise, she said, "You're going to drive me to Newtown." Mm. And so when I heard this, I was just absolutely stunned that this kind of thing would happen in that particular place. Mm. But mainly for me, what your talk raised so deeply is that sort of antidote to, sort of the conventional idea of enlightenment and Zen, which is indeed to get away, to somehow find a way of being unperturbed by the world.
Yeah.
And I just, actually, for me, my biggest problem is coming back to the beauty of the world. And I focus a lot on the suffering of the world, but to be able to see both and to be fully human with both is really key. And I thank you for that.
I'm glad that message came through. A little concerned that all I was bringing out was the grief.
No.
But the whole point of Ruby's poem is that there is a path that will give us the resilience to deal with the emptiness and fear.
Well, the other thing too is that don't open the door to the study, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Because I have a tendency to want to do that, to explain, figure it out, how did this happen? And it's just perfect.
With regard to sitting on the same piece of rock, when I heard about it and I felt the feeling of the whole country, it was huge. I've studied foreign policy for a long time, and I just think
could we take the next, could we connect the next dot? Mm-hmm. Because as a country, we're insane. I mean, well, we've been killing people overseas and daily, thousands, you know, and little kids. And somehow it's really hits us when it happens here, mm-hmm. by ourselves, our own insanity. So anyway, I feel like, gosh, I don't know how we're going to stop it. Yeah. But we have to, I feel I have to try. And it's really hard. You can't do it by yourself. So that's it.
Well, Melinda, it reminds me of something that I intended to say in the talk that I'd forgotten. One of the chapters in Zen Mind Meeting of Mind, I forget which, he talks about that people, young people, are inclined to criticize our culture, especially young people, mm-hmm. and that young people criticize our culture may be all right. It may mean they're coming back to the simple truth that would have left us. But more important than just to criticize your culture is to establish yourself in our simple way. And then society and culture will grow out of you. And I think he's got a point, you know. This point is similar to what Peter Moore and Dorothy Day's mentor said, is that our task is to create a new society within the shell of the old. Mm-hmm. So, I think the most important thing is to find the courage to stay human,
yeah.
and live here in this world in that way,
mm-hmm.
and then do what the heart prompts. If the heart prompts social justice work, that's mm-hmm. certainly fine. If it prompts mm-hmm. educational efforts,
right.
it's certainly fine, but...
It's how you are.
But, so that's why I hear Suzuki Roshi talking about devoting ourselves to this simple way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, living lives of beauty. Letting the beauty we love be what we do. Living beautiful lives.
Mm-hmm.
That, and the beauty that's coming forth from plain humanity, you know, and that's the essential saving grace. And if all we do is get filled with anger and despair and outrage about the dirty rotten system, in Dorothy Day's words, then we'll lose that kernel, we'll lose mm-hmm. that acorn.
It doesn't work to bump up against it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So that was
just something I was just thinking. It seemed like such a pointer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To pick up the instrument in the morning, I find that the playing of music or the singing of a bird or child laughing, it actually changes the vibrational frequency
mm-hmm.
in the area. You can
mm-hmm.
see,
yeah.
actually, there's something I've seen. Piece of rubber that was twisted with music, it actually shook and straightened out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's part of it is, of course, bringing beauty into the area
yeah.
and putting that out into the world.
Yeah.
Besides seeing the suffering to change the world, even on a microscopic level,
mm-hmm.
in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
To have a view there.
Yeah.
And you think of a garden planted in a slum, it's almost like the beauty radiates out from there and can change that area and those people.
Mm-hmm.
So the picking up of the instrument is not it's not like the cricket fiddling or something, you know, it's important.
Mm-hmm. Very, very,
yeah.
very important.
And we tend to think of that as not important, but
mm-hmm. yeah.
I think it physically and spiritual
gifts. Mm-hmm. I know that for a fact. I know that for a fact. I had the experience of bringing my guitar to the shelter and playing. And I don't play slasher rock. No, if there's any slasher rock fans, I apologize. I play classical, you know, and the vibrations that sets forth are not just acoustical vibrations, you know, and the ambiance of the room, and everybody's affected. Mm-hmm. And it's not like a panacea. It doesn't. It's not a guarantee that there's not going to be things happening, but it's certainly injecting an element into the environment that has an inevitable effect. You know, on some days it may not be potent enough to circumvent other effects, but it nonetheless always has an effect as long as there's conditions that will allow it to be present. And I also know from experience that on the days when I drive to work and I'm chanting the Dai Shindarani as I'm going to work, my day tends to start out a lot nicer than if I just have, you know, if I'm lost in thought. I'm letting monkey mind keep me busy. Then when I get there, my unconsciousness, my relative unconsciousness, is met with all the oppressive elements of the environment. When I chant the Dai Shindarani, when I feel soft and open, vulnerable, ironically vulnerable, then the grace of the environment and the humanity of the people or more available. Whereas when I'm not open and vulnerable, I don't perceive the humanity as readily. I just see demonized crackheads, you know, tucked in their cubbies. I've talked about that before. And so, yeah, so that's very true. And playing the instrument can mean a lot of things. But, you know, proactively, there's an expression, I forget the Japanese, but it's usually translated assuming your Dharma position. You know, our humanity has an agency to it, and we can bring that to the table. We can bring that to the context of the moment.
Mm-hmm. I actually brought you a poem today.
Yeah.
And in that, I mean, I have it not in my head necessarily, but it talks about the suffering on the planet and the women standing by the well who are laughing and smiling together, even though there's someone sick in the village, and even though they know horrible things are coming. Mm-hmm. And it talks about our going into anger and staying in even righteous anger diminishes their suffering. And so it's our job, really, to be able to see the suffering and show up and celebrate. Mm-hmm. And celebrate the beauty, celebrate life. Mm-hmm. In the beginning of this year, I think has been extraordinary in the in a lot of the pain, in the place where we find ourselves, and the awakening. I'm really feeling a quickening in our finally waking up as a species. And I always think that when I find a new radio station or something, and I think, oh, it's a new radio station, even because I just discovered it, right? Mm-hmm. But it feels to me like it's like the 100th monkey. Mm-hmm. People are enough people now really are seeing the deception and the greed and the suffering and all of that, and so now the courage to step up. And so that's part of my prayer, that stop the judging and show up with the courage to be present and to be honest and speak out. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for today. Thank you.
Hello.
this morning, I can share a story that might be relevant. I look out my window, all the birds are feeding away, and there, very quietly, moves this huge coyote right by my home. A huge one. Coyote. Mm-hmm. Oh, huge. Very quiet. Mm-hmm. Howard. And my cat is outside. Oh, dear. So I go running around, I get my dog engaged, and she goes bark, 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 and I'm looking, yelling for my cat. And there is my cat, found a safe place underneath my dad, who's just smiling at the whole incident, like, I'm fine. But it was a wonderful combination of the scary, the potential for danger,
yeah,
and the being quite okay. Energy. And I end up smiling, my cat is, no problem. But we have to have the caring of life and the appreciation of that beautiful coyote. I mean, I called it a danger to it, but it's a beautiful wild creature. Mm-hmm. Coming so close to my house, I felt very honored and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So all these feelings. You know,
mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a Tai Chi move called Race the Tiger.
Oh, yeah.
And in hearing your story about the coyote and the birds and your cat,
yeah,
reminded me of last night at work. I'd been sick, and so I hadn't been to work at all last week. Because Monday and Tuesday, I was taking his vacation days because I had my son with me. And then on Wednesday, I was so sick that I didn't go to work. And then last night, I felt like, you know, I hadn't been present for the women's shelter for several days, and I was concerned about that because we've made some changes, and I've been trying to be present to support staff in enforcing the changes in the rules for the shelter. And so I went there and said, well, I should show up, bring my glorious presence to the staff to give them moral support. And, you know, I had these noble, somewhat inflated ambitions to, like, you know, support my staff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got there. I said, well, I'll just show up, grace them with my presence for a while, then I'll come back home and play my guitar. And that was my plan. And then I got there, and then one of our guests was very, very drunk, and her boyfriend, who's living in the men's shelter upstairs, was also very drunk. He snuck her upstairs against the rules, and they got caught, and the staff person upstairs evicted her. And so she was coming downstairs all weepy, crying, feeling abused because she couldn't stay up with her boyfriend. And her boyfriend, who knew the jig was up, was like, just go downstairs and be quiet. Let's not make it any worse than it already is. We're already in trouble. But she was too drunk to actually do that. She just felt egregiously wounded because she volunteers so much in our soup kitchen that she should be treated much nicer. And so she saw me, and she grabbed my hand tightly and says, Rick, I really need to talk. And I thought, oh, jeez. I was planning on being out of here. And so I went into the office with her to talk, and I was angry. I was kind of pissed off. I said, you know, you probably will never meet her. I'll go ahead and use her name, Terry. You know, she's very drunk and she's feeling sorry for herself, and she's, you know, trying to manipulate the situation. And I could feel how angry I was. Mainly because my plan to just make a graceful appearance and then disappear had been thwarted, you know. And I was delayed getting back to my guitar. And fortunately, I had enough self-awareness to recognize that, you know, my frustration and my agenda being disrupted was fueling resentment and anger towards Terry. And so there was this tiger, or this coyote, that at first all I was coyote. Then I was able to, like, push the coyote to the side a little bit, and I could see that, okay, yeah, she's drunk. She's very, very drunk, but she's got pools of tears in her eyes, and she was squeezing my hand tightly, and she wasn't faking that. She's not faking the level of her emotional distress. The fact that it's alcohol fueled is kind of like beside the point that she, you know, there is genuine human distress, and she really does feel like she's being oppressed. And you know, she's in her late 30s. You're, you know, we're telling her that she can't be with her man because we get these rules that are infantilizing her. The rules are necessary, but they have the unfortunate consequence of reaffirming the marginalization of folks, you know, because, you know, we're treating them like children, but we have to because otherwise we have chaos. So I was able to see all of this. And I was able to access the coyote to tell her, hey, right now you got to get a grip or you're going to be sleeping outside. That's your choice, okay? You got to get a grip so you can control your behavior, or the staff persons are going to make you leave. You know, so it's very interesting. So I was able to embrace the coyote in, I hope, a non-harmful way, and hopefully Terry was able to get some. She was able in that moment, anyway, to get some measure of grip on her behavior.
Yeah, that's really interesting. How one little event, one could almost spin out a whole book about life, you know, if I look at this a little bit more deeply.
Yeah.
But the ending point with my cat just smiling down, I'd be like, oh, you're running around.
And also, in my story, I think, illustrates, from my perspective, it's the riskiness of trying to be fully human. Because, you know, because the anger, you know, to be fully human, I have to be able to be angry. But if I dive headfirst into the anger, then I can become capable of anything. But then if I try to disown the anger, then it's going to work its business on my psychology in the dark and twist me some other way. So it's a razor's edge. Full transparency, full vulnerability, full honesty within the context of vow, within the context of, you know, commitment to be really good. Okay, that's probably more than enough. Okay, universal dedication, page 8.
May this merit extend universally to all, so that we together with all beings realize the Buddha way. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, my